Having worked for 35 years as a cameraman and producer for every major US television news network and the Foreign Press Corps, Tim Altman understands firsthand the television news production process with over three decades of experience shooting, lighting, editing, writing, story editing, and producing, occupying a front row seat during significant events from war, revolution, terrorist attacks to famine and Cold War summits, the fall of communism, Olympiads and Olympic Park bombings, presidential elections, and the occasional press conference. Altman knows the validity of traditional news media, and he's stepping out from behind the camera to tell his story in a new book, Newsreel, A View Through the Lens When. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the United States, author of Newsreel, Tim Altman. Tim, good afternoon for us. Good morning for you, I think.
Well, good morning, Charles, and thank you for having me.
The pleasure is all mine. We live in an interesting time in terms of news at the moment. Words such as fake news are being bandied about. There's the thought of are traditional news media, or is traditional news media valid in a world with social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram? Perhaps you got involved in I can almost say gentler, softer time. Tell me a little bit about your introduction to the media world.
Well, I was very fortunate to join NBC News at a very early age, and the book chronicles that. It's a memoir about my time spent overseas as a young staff cameraman as part of the Foreign Press Corps, and it takes place, as you mentioned, during the 80s, which was a very tumultuous time for me. It started with the war in Lebanon and concluded with the fall of communism in Eastern Europe, and throughout that whole time I felt a real sense of camaraderie with the other dedicated men and women with whom I worked covering news, and was supremely proud to work with NBC News and the greater broadcast news business. And when I went to write the book, I wanted to write more than a memoir, and given the climate we're in right now with all the media bashing, I thought it was an opportunity to remind people and the reader that in a free society like ours, a strong and independent news media is a really vital, critical role and a really valuable tool.
It's interesting that you cut your teeth, as it were, being sent to the Lebanon as a U.S. reporter. Of course, the Middle East, especially today, is at the forefront of everybody's news media feeds. You said before that Lebanon taught you that there wasn't black and white, there weren't good guys and bad guys, but something like 82 shades of gray in between.
It was a very complex story, and as a 25-year-old cameraman on my first real international conflict, I thought it was good versus evil, and it's never that simple, and it's very complex. And I, with the help of a lot of colleagues who knew that story much more, much better than I did, and were more involved in it previously, I got up to speed and I learned it, and it was, like you said, a real way to cut my teeth and understand the complexity of a lot of international news events and diplomacy.
So, I mean, what did you take out of that first posting over in the Middle East, and how did it help form you in terms of how you reported news, how you edited news, and how you got the feeling of what was going on back to a public sitting in their front rooms back in the US? I mean, you mentioned it was a time then when anchormen were more trusted than presidents.
Yeah, for me, on that first trip to Lebanon, we, for instance, we got into some really scary situation. We were trapped in the Shuf Mountains as the Israelis had withdrawn back to southern Lebanon, and a huge battle erupted, and we were trapped. We were in a Muslim-controlled territory. The sect of the Muslims was called Druze, and they'd been there for centuries, and they knew we were there, and they were our only hope out, and they said, if you leave, you know, the roads are mine, there's snipers everywhere. If we can, when this battle ceases, we'll try and get you back to safety. And that's exactly what happened. One morning, they pulled up with a heavily armed convoy of jeeps and fighters, and they delivered us to a demilitarized area where they handed us off to the Lebanese army. And going in there, you know, you didn't know who the players were or who to trust, but we put our safety in their hands, and they really did save us. So it taught me that the people on the ground, it's a much more complex story, and these people were to be trusted, and their friendships were formed. And And it kind of formed the way I view the world. It's a complex thing, and we need to empathize and develop common feelings with a lot of different people.
And it's interesting because it's only 35 years ago that you were on the ground in the Lebanon, which is the blink of an eye when you consider history. But when you look at the way that the news landscape has changed since the 80s, since the 90s, you might say, or even since the millennium, with the explosion of network news, of news. There was what you call the Big Four reporting back in the day. And now that whole landscape has gone, and there are thousands of news channels out there. What difference has that made to the way that people report?
Yeah, it has changed drastically. And back then, when the book takes place, you're right, there were four highly trusted entities, and the competition was limited, and anchormen were trusted more than presidents, and the news divisions weren't viewed as a revenue source so much. We weren't focused so much on profitability. We were allowed to just cover news, and the profits at the networks were generated by the entertainment divisions and the big hit shows, and the news was kind of looked down as a higher calling, like a civic obligation. But today, the realities, the complexities of that have changed, and it's gone from four networks to 300 channels, and I contend there still is very good, award-winning, fact-based journalism being conducted, but it shares a space now with a lot of online opinion and TV talk show that masquerades as news. So it's difficult now for the viewer to discern which is fact-based journalism, and as we used to do it solely, and the more cloudy, opinionated reporting.
Also, the thing with having the big four news channels, and obviously UK based, we have the BBC and ITN.
Of course.
They had foreign bureaus. They were able to throw manpower and thought at an event, you know, at a news story. I mean, I remember working on national newspapers and having the futures desk, and we would be working on things that were going to be coming up, you know, in the next, say, month or something. And somebody like the Sunday Times could do an insight and send a team off to Africa and do a 2-month piece building on sanctions or Soweto or something like that. Today, that isn't an option that we can have.
Sadly, no. And the BBC was, when I was overseas, the gold standard, I think, still is today. They do an incredible job. But that world service, as it were, and certainly with American networks, as viewership decreased, they began to close some of those bureaus, many of those bureaus. Back when the book takes place, there were bureaus in every major capital and major city throughout the world. And today, most of it's being covered out of London. Very well, but when you have people and places on the ground in a number of different cities, you're both global and you're very agile, you're very nimble, and you can pivot and cover a story at the moment's notice. And that was the case in Ethiopia. The BBC broke that story with this horrible famine in the north and west, in the part of Ethiopia. And the next day, we were the first American network in there to cover what was a horrible, terrible famine in what is now called Eritrea. And no one had seen it. No one had heard about it. And we mobilized and got in there, and were ill-prepared for the death and all the dying that was going on up there on a massive biblical scale. But we got the pictures out, and that's the way the business should operate. A very benevolent world donated hundreds of millions of dollars. There were still upwards of 5 million people that perished from a terrible death of a famine, but It shows that the good that the news media can do and still does today.
And the thing is, though, I mean, you mentioned that, and I remember sitting and watching that 1984 Michael Burke for the BBC reporting, and he used the word
exactly.
biblical too, and we had seen none of this because we were living in a world without social media, without that instant, picture being flashed on social media. And would you argue, and you could argue, that doing what you did, going in with a dedicated team and with your experience to report on a subject as huge as that, enabled people to respond in the appropriate manner. Whereas today, if you dropped 4,000 influencers, as they call themselves, with Instagram accounts and social media, the amount of information coming in doesn't have that filter that you need from a good editor stroke producer.
I could completely agree. It's social media is here. Fortunately, change is good. It gives the anytime you give the consumer more choice, that's a good thing. But to your point, Facebook and Twitter, I don't consider real news sources. A lot of times, they simply regurgitate what's being reported on the New York Times or NBC News or some other verifiable news source. And you're right. A lot of people just are opining and putting their thoughts forward, which is not journalism. I mean, so you have to be careful and discern what is online opinion and what's real news, and what's, you know, when you check your sources three times and you verify the reports that you're printing, and that's true journalism. And that's the kind of award-winning stuff that is, you know, receiving Pulitzer Prizes and Peabody's and DuPont's. Those kind of awards are still being given out today. I just don't know that they're being handed out to places like online sources like Facebook and Twitter.
You mentioned that, so the fake news, and you make some interesting points in your book about the fact that you think that the somebody saying hashtag fake news is a way of swerving and creating a smokescreen to covering what could be a potentially, you know, huge issue.
It is. Well, I entitled the book News Real, spelled R-E-A-L, to address this phenomenon of fake news head on, and I believe that when you label something fake news, it is a smokescreen. It's a diversionary tactic to try and distract the viewer or the reader or the listener from news that at its heart is fact-based but may not be all that flattering or all that complimentary. So you would label it fake news in an attempt to take the focus, the attention somewhere else down the road. And while, again, the reporting can be true and fact-based.
You also mentioned that the beginning, the fact that when you started out in the Lebanon, you had your entertainment division who were to bring in revenue by the, you know, the cutesy stories, and you were seen as the higher calling because you were doing proper, you know, fact based news, and perhaps with the advent of so many TV channels that who are driven by the sound bite rather than the sound story, the entertainment news it's been flipped on its head. So the entertainment news, and suddenly what some soap opera star is doing or what some reality TV star is doing is given the same billing as a major foreign event.
It's a sad development, but true. So we when we were in the news divisions, we were isolated from all of that. And bear in mind, we didn't have a 24-hour news cycle quite yet. It was just coming into play with CNN. So once you throw in the 24-hour news cycle, you need to fill up the grocery basket, so to speak, with something. So there is still plenty of real news out there, but now you've got 24 hours and you have to either spin it in a different capacity or a different slant, or put on something more entertaining. And I enjoy talk shows as much as anyone. I'll tune into it and watch Sunday morning talk shows, but I also know that it's not... It's clouded with a lot of opinion, and it's not fact-based news all the time. So I have to remember that, and I think viewers should remember that as well.
And how do you weigh up being a journalist, being a cameraman, being a reporter in 21st century America, when you argue for that you need a strong independent media, and at the same time you have politicians and the president saying that these people pointing to the front row where the press pit are sitting and the photographers saying these people are enemies of the state?
Yeah, that's real bothersome. The press, the news media that he maligns, is that they're doing their job. He's the president of the United States. They're supposed to be reporting on the president of the United States. And frankly, all presidents, going all the way back to Thomas Jefferson, you know, bristled at times with the coverage that was written about them or broadcast about them. But at the end of the day, they all realized that the job we do as journalists is a real cornerstone to our democracy. And I, you know, it wasn't that long ago George W. Bush was a popular two-term president, and he wasn't always covered with the most flattering light. But when he left office, he said power can be very addictive. It can be corrosive, and it's important for the media to call to account people who abuse their power. That's a Republican president saying that. So, you know, let's keep in mind that this role of watchdog journalism is an important, valuable role that the media provides for us, the people.
I mean, if you're not asking why and putting the questions and pricking a few balloons, as we would say over here, then we might as well just be regurgitating press releases and statements coming out of various offices.
Absolutely. And as a guy who carried a camera in five different countries covering news around the world, I've seen those countries where there isn't a free independent media. There isn't a voice for the people. There is a voice for the voiceless, whether it's a totalitarian dictatorship or a one-party communist regime or whatever it is. There's a lot of places where they don't benefit from the right to have a free, independent, uncensored media. And you don't want to be in those places. It's a real luxury to have the uncensored media that we have.
So why did you decide that the time was right to write the book? Why this book, and why now?
Well, there are some very interesting stories and entertaining stories of perilous news coverage throughout the world, and after hearing those from friends and colleagues enough, I was urged to write a book. And when you hear that enough and enough and enough, you decide, okay, maybe I should write a book. And I did, and oddly enough, a publisher found it very intriguing and worthwhile. So it moved forward, and I think the media now is a very topical idea, and it's one that I wanted to address, having 30 years of experience and very favorable experiences, very fortunate to have worked in it. I wanted to share those experiences, and as I said, you know, remind people that this is a right that we're so fortunate to have. So it's we should not be so quick to malign or embrace the hatred that's vented towards the media.
I mean, was it when you did your first draft? Was it quite? And you look through an astonishing 35-year career in the media, covering so many different countries. Is it difficult to sort of like pull back a little bit and not make it sound as if it's a boy's own adventure story with the you know, the heroic cameraman staggering through the, you know, we always had these images of the foreign correspondents.
I have that cameraman voice. That's what I was early on in my career. So it was difficult to modulate that voice, and it's very much told in a camera. It's not an executive producer or a network executive in New York or anybody. It's from somebody who lived it. And again, I benefited from so much learning and assistance and help from all the colleagues, the dedicated men and women that I worked with. There was a real sense of camaraderie, and I wanted to put that in the book as well. And I've been told that it reads almost like a novel, but my follow-up is that the truth is sometimes stranger than fiction. So these things really did happen, and they're still going on around the world today. I wish that not so much news was originating out of Washington, D.C., and that we had more of this kind of world news being reported on to kind of buffer all the stuff that the contentious news coming out of Washington, D.C.
There have been so many experiences in your 35 years out there in the field. When you sat down to write the book, was there one image, was there one story that you thought, out of all the years, this was the point where it all made sense? Was it arriving at Eritrea? Was it being in Lebanon and spending 5 days to be escorted out by the Druze? Or was there something else, you know, being in Eastern Europe with the fall of communism, for example? What particular moment for you marked that, as Hunter S. Thompson would say, the high watermark, if you like?
It's difficult to pinpoint a favorite story. There were so many, and I was so involved in all of them. But in the end of 1989, when we were assigned to a tiny little village on the West German-Czechoslovakian border to go cover a train station in the middle at midnight of a trainload full of East German refugees coming through Czechoslovakia from Prague. It was a head scratcher. We had no idea what this was, because communism looked like it was to last forever. It wasn't toppling or it wasn't crumbling. So to find out more, we actually got visas and went into Prague, and sure enough, these East Germans who could travel freely behind the Iron Curtain were going into Czechoslovakia, making a beeline straight for the West German consulate in Prague and handing their children and their relatives and everybody climbing over the wall of the embassy to get onto West German territory. And that led to a mass, 5,000 people were on that eventually in those grounds, and they had to have these trains evacuate these people from Czechoslovakia. It was horribly embarrassing for East Germany and the Czechs, but it led to the opening of the Berlin Wall, and then literally a week later, the Czechoslovakian communists were still in power and didn't feel like relinquishing control, and some protesters were protesting, and we were covering it, and the military police and the police, everybody just severely beat the protesters and ourselves. But we were able to get those pictures out, and within days, the massive strikes were called, and the Communist Party crumbled in Czechoslovakia, and free democratic elections were called. It was a real change in course for that country, and to be there witnessing it, and to see an oppressive system like communism collapse, and to have recorded it was unforgettable for me. It was wonderful.
When do you hope that people would? What do you hope that people will take out of your book, then?
Well, I think anybody who picks up The Guardian or The New York Times or watches the BBC World Service or NBC News and who is interested in information news, I think will enjoy this book. It's, again, a first-hand account of many interesting news stories. And throughout it, I try and make a case that the news media really is doing a wonderful job, and the mainstream news media, and we need to focus on that bedrock mainstream news media, which is still very much alive and well, both then and now, plays an important role in our lives.
The book is called Newsreel. It's out now on Incognito Press. It's out on.
Yes, it actually comes out. It's available today. I've been invited to speak this evening at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library. So we're using today as the official launch. So you can find it online at Amazon.com and BarnesandNobleBooks.com, and it's available it will be available in bookstores soon.
If people want to find out more about you or the book, is there an online presence? I know we talked about social media and Twitter and all that thing, but can people find out more about you? Do you have a website, that sort of thing?
I am on Facebook and Twitter, and the handle is at Tim Ortman Writer.
The book is called Newsreel. It's out now. It's by Tim Ortman. Tim Ortman, thanks very much for your time today.
Giles, it's been a real pleasure. I appreciate you having me on.